Hi, I'm Ray Dubicki, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life. In this week's episode, we're going to talk with author Alexandra Lang. She is a design critic with work appearing in Harvard Design Magazine, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg City Lab. Her book is Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. It covers a whole lot of things you didn't know that went into making malls and how they have changed and changed us. Meet Me by the Fountain is the next selection for the Urbanist Book Club. Hi, Alexandra, and welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
So that means we're going to do some reminiscing about hanging out by the fountain, try some weird Valley Girl accents, and probably talk a lot about zombie movies. Stick around. So, Alexandra, when someone hears you wrote a book about malls, what's their reaction?
Well, typically they launch into a reminiscence about their mall because, you know, 90% of people who are 50 and under in the US, you know, grew up in a city that had a mall, if not multiple malls, and spent their teen years there. And they have a lot to say about that time.
I was debating whether or not my first question was going to be, what happened to Ferrell's and why did I love it so much when it was at my mall? And yeah, so I completely understand that reaction.
I don't think I know what Ferrell's is, though.
Oh my gosh. No, it was a weird ice cream shop that appeared in like one mall on the East Coast, and it was Golden Ring Mall. So
Okay. No, I mean, one of the great things about malls is like, yes, they're kind of the same everywhere, but then there are also regional variations. And, you know, one of the things I discovered when I was researching the book is, you know, where certain major mall developers were from, you know, sort of regional patterns in terms of development of malls. You know, people have told me about lots of different, basically, you know, ice cream stores, smoothie shops, other things that were maybe at two or three malls in their town. So it's like, no matter how mass produced something can seem, still, like, it, if it's a physical artifact on the ground, there's all this regional variation, and that's really what makes it fun.
Now, from your design background, what do you see when you think of what do you see in a mall in that regional variation kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, one thing I love is how, so one of the variations of malls is something called lifestyle centers, which were built in the late 90s and early 2000s. And those are really making the mall outdoors again. They would still have an anchor department store at either end and shops in between, but they kind of took the roof off. And one of the aspects of lifestyle centers is they really wanted them to look like, you know, the main street of this imaginary town. So that meant that the lifestyle centers often have the iconography of whatever you would consider the local architecture. So a lifestyle center in Connecticut will have red brick veneer and white pediments over some of the stores, whereas one in Texas might be adobe. You know, a Southwestern one might have little tile ornaments. And like, all of that is really fun because it really points up how stage set like many of these things are. And if you look at those lifestyle centers, you'll see the plan underneath is basically always the same. It's just this really thin veneer of regional architecture.
At one point in your book, you start going through the alphabet of what the shape of particular malls were. And I think you had an O, you had a V, you had an I. What's the weirdest one that's popped up for you?
I think it's when you get an F mall. So a mall that looks like an F basically probably started as a mall that looked like an I, which is the simplest form of mall, which is one department store at either end, and then a straight run of, you know, two sets of shops going down. And then at some point, someone says, oh, you know what, we want a third department store. So they send off, you know, a bar from the middle and add a third department store at the end of that. And then at some point, somebody else says, you know, we really need a movie theater. So then they send a bar off from one of the department store ends and add a movie theater at the end of that. So when you look at the plan, you're like, nobody would ever plan something like this. It's really far from one end to the other. Like, it doesn't make sense, but it only makes sense as this mall is 30 or 40 years old and you've added these things on and you never really thought about what it was like as a path.
One of the characters that shows up in the book about midway through is a guy named James Rouse. And having grown up in Baltimore, he's kind of a big name. When you start talking about an F mall, one of his creations was Columbia Mall. And apparently at one point it was supposed to be a total square and they went F in a lot of ways. Because there's a Nordstrom's end that headed west and another thing. And then they put a lifestyle center right outside next to it.
Right. And it's kind of a mess. And I mean, I feel like the early malls, when they were quite simple, have a certain amount of beauty and legibility. And then these malls that have just had things stuck on, parts enclosed, lifestyle center, et cetera, are really ugly. I mean, malls are always a little bit ugly because, you know, curbside appeal was actually like not important to their bottom line. But these agglomerated malls really lose all sense of planning in terms of expediency.
Now, when you start talking about the original malls, you're talking about these Victor Gruen designed pieces in, what was it, Michigan and outside of Detroit. Did you get to visit any of these?
I visited some of them in the past. And yeah, sorry, I sort of skipped over you mentioning James Rouse, but basically I consider Victor Gruen the first great mall innovator and James Rouse really the second great mall innovator. So Victor Gruen was this Austrian emigre, and his first major shopping center was Northland, which is just outside of Detroit, which I visited in the past, but it is one of these malls that really suffers from agglomeration. It was originally a shopping center, which meant it wasn't indoors, and parts of it had been enclosed over the years. More things had been added on. So its original form was not really apparent. Gruen's second mall was Southdale in Edina, Minnesota, outside Minneapolis. And part of that still exists in its original form. But again, it's been much added onto over the years. And that was really one of the issues, you know, for the mall scholar, shall we say, is that, you know, malls are 70 years old now. Malls are supposed to make money. So they're kind of continuously updated. They're on the same kind of fashion cycles as the wares that are sold in malls in a way that a lot of architecture isn't. And so to find a pristine mall that's kind of in mint 1960s condition is really difficult. And the second chapter of my book is about North Park in Dallas, which is now an O mall, but started as an L. And the first, you know, two sides of the L are still in mint condition. You can see them as they looked in 1965. And that's actually kind of a precious commodity and really was really interesting to me. And I devoted some time to that in the book because it's just such a rarity.
At one point in one of the department stores, you said it has this kind of rounded outside that you don't realize until you get inside that it serves a design purpose, that those are like skylit fitting rooms, that the actual outside architecture meant something, which is a rarity in malls.
Yeah, so that's the Neiman Marcus store at North Park in Dallas. And that was designed by Kevin Roach and John Dinkaloo, who were Eero Saarinen's partners. So it's also kind of a major work of architecture that most people don't realize has that kind of pedigree. But yeah, the outside of it, like the rest of North Park, is very beautiful white brick. But yes, it has these half circle protuberances. And at first you think, oh, that's just kind of some kind of decoration. But if you end up in the women's fashion department at the Neiman Marcus, you find out that those are these daylit changing rooms so people could see what the clothes would look like in proper light. Yeah, and that's just a really interesting like little fashion twist that most department stores at malls don't have. Like they're usually just a big box with the logo stuck on the side.
I can't think of the last time I actually had to go into a changing room in order to try something on, but they do tend to be just like the back corner. And the only thing that you recognize is that somebody is standing out there, you know, hopefully taking things off the rack and putting them back. But even that's kind of faded out too.
Yes. I mean, many people don't well, many people don't like to go to changing rooms, mostly because of the lighting. The lighting is often bad. But, you know, as I've been promoting the book this fall, you know, we've gotten to a different point in the pandemic. And so people are starting to talk about bricks and mortar shopping again, and like, is it going to come back? And I have to say that a lot of people miss changing rooms because they're so tired of having to order three sizes of everything and try it on at home and send it back. Like, there's actually some amount of efficiency in a changing room that maybe we forgot about a little bit.
That kind of brings up the mall as this, in a way, technological marvel, that there was a whole lot of technology things, changes that went into it. And honestly, I never thought of like fixed prices for a good or clothing as a technological step. When you got to all of these feeder technologies coming into the mall, what was the biggest thing you think was the change that malls made to the technology to make them successful?
Well, I think the most, you know, kind of important technology for the success of the mall was really climate control. You know, like the mall as we know it is an invention of the post-war era. That's also when, you know, air conditioning and climate control become really important in office buildings. You know, post-war skyscrapers are kind of the, you know, modernist architecture example par excellence of the post-war era. But malls are also really important, you know, climate controlled modernist architecture of the post-war era. And that, in fact, was how Victor Gruen sold his clients in Minneapolis on an indoor mall or an enclosed shopping center. The ads for it all said, you know, shop at Southdale 365 shopping days a year, because typically people did not shop in Minneapolis in the dead of winter or actually in the very humid summers. So, you know, being able to condition a large space like the atrium of a mall became incredibly important. And I think that's one of the reasons that atriums, including their fountains, are such an important part of the mall story, because this idea of, you know, an artificial perpetual spring was really initiated by Victor Gruen, and then perpetuated by, you know, future mall designers. And, you know, before that, air conditioning had been used more for commercial spaces, movie theaters, and kind of more enclosed spaces. But being able to condition really like this large open space that also had skylights was really important.
I have to say that since reading your book, I have been to the mall and paid attention to the fact that when you are in that main atrium and you have the ceiling over top and the big lights and things along those lines, it does feel like this just a temple of shopping. And very quickly, though, you step away from that and you find that, oh, they're kind of doing a little bit of cutting corners in certain places in order to make the center so much showier in so many ways. Where it's never too far from mind that this is a commercial operation. How did being a commercial operation really keep everybody at the cutting edge for so many years?
Well, I think the mall is really, I mean, we talk now about things online and, you know, beta testing. I feel like the mall was really a place where both the mall developers and the retailers and the managers were constantly beta testing things. Like I mentioned earlier, the outside of malls are pretty ugly. Many of the initial malls that Gruen designed actually had some sort of exterior architecture, like a colonnade to kind of gesture, you know, at it being a public building in a neoclassical way. But it really didn't matter to shoppers whether the outside was totally plain or it had a nice little colonnade and plantings. So they decided, you know what, you know, we're trying to make the maximum amount of money. We'll focus our money on the atrium. And then again, at a mall like North Park, all of the finishes are very nice. That was an early mall and, you know, it was a fairly high-end mall. But yeah, if it turns out that people's mental picture of your mall just has the beautiful fountain, and they don't really think about, you know, the flooring or the walls, you know, between the individual boutiques off to the sides. And yeah, let's put all money in the center, because the mind kind of edits out the rest of it that might be just much more plain and utilitarian. So I feel like you can see malls as they're like, should we spend money here? Nope, nobody cares. Like, we won't spend money there anymore. And so forth. I mean, you can also think about spaces like arcades, which are such a huge part of malls in the 80s, as another one of those like, oh, we actually don't need to spend money on that, because the arcades were a business that could thrive in, you know, the narrow hallways that were between the exterior door and that atrium, you know, these kind of off to the side spaces that were really never going to be prime real estate, because the arcade is totally internal to itself. It doesn't need to have even artificial, you know, kind of daylight effect. So it was a great thing to put into like your cheapest, like lowest rent spaces in your mall. And I think that's why the arcade could spread so quickly, because every mall had these spaces that were hard to rent. And it was like, oh, these people don't care about lights. They want it to be dark. We just like, you know, stick a bunch of these video game consoles in a room. Great.
They're not looking up too much anyway. Let's
no. They're totally focused, you know, like we are now, like on their screen. And actually the dark ambiance is part of the allure, right? Because it adds to your ability to just kind of focus on your, you know, magical world, superhero world, whatever else.
We have a establishment in Seattle called Town Hall that is a lecture pavilion, huge city asset of just a place to have talks and shows and things like that. And it's in the location of a church. Mm-hmm. It's a great historic church that was one of the Church of Christ's from back in the early turn of the century, last century. And they made the point that it only really sustained itself there because the church kind of went on a long descent into losing population and people not attending. Had it been a quick one, the whole place would have gotten turned over and renovated as something else. But because it had this like swan song, it got preserved until it got changed over into a use that really respected the historic nature of the building. And so when you talk about some of the malls in the book, it came to mind because they preserved some of the 1960s aesthetic because they were not as big of a flip as other things. I grew up, like I said, in Baltimore near Owings Mills Mall, that was a super rocket ship north and a fantastic place to go until real quick it wasn't. And you have a picture in there of it being a shell of itself with ferns folding over and things like that.
Yeah, I know. Owings Mills was a really beautiful mall. It kind of hit all the high spots of mall architecture in terms of, you know, having this beautiful food court with like a glass roof and palm trees and, you know, really big central atrium, like great materials. I mean, all the old photos of it look amazing. And I read a lot of articles about the opening of it, which was a huge deal for that zone of Baltimore suburbs. I mean, that was actually one of the things that made me, you know, sad about a lot of these malls, like what a big deal it was for their respective areas when they opened. Like they were really seen as this civic resource. And I think that they did, in fact, play that role for a long time. And so then when they become this drag on the economy, this kind of blank spot, like along the urban highway, like it is a huge deal. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how, you know, people kind of like the aesthetics of dead mall photography, but to me, the physical realities of that are really sad and kind of depressing, which takes away from my appreciation for the look of the photography.
We're with Alexandra Lang talking about her book, Meet Me by the Fountain. Now, usually next to the fountain, there was something a little bit important that everybody congregated around, and that was the food court. What is your favorite spot to go to a mall food court?
Well, I guess I'm an Auntie Anne's person. A lot of people are always asking me, you know, Cinnabon or Auntie Anne's, and I'm definitely on the Auntie Anne's side. Cinnabon is like just too much of a sugar bomb for me.
It's the size of a spare tire. Let's be honest.
I know. I mean, I get that it smells delicious, and I have a little like side note in the book about how, you know, Cinnabon has special fans to blow that cinnamon sugar smell out towards people so they know when they're hot. But yeah, no, I love the pretzels. In newfangled food courts, I also love bubble tea, which I write a bit about in the book. I mean, one of the fun things to think about was just how sugary treats have played this important part in mall history. You know, Mrs. Fields does still exist, but it used to be, it was quite a big deal when it opened up. It was kind of a phenomenon as a food business. And having small, you know, kiosks in malls really helped that business to grow.
I can't think of the last time I saw Mrs. Fields. It was totally in the mall because, and people coming up to buy their giant cookie. Was that the one that did the giant cookie cake where you got your name written on it? And
off, yeah, it's like a cookie pizza. And it seemed really exciting as a kid.
Well, I mean, the things, you need two hands to get across it. And yeah, that is the most exciting. I was, when you mentioned arcades before, I was thinking, I did have a birthday party at the mall arcade, and the pizza place across from it did a deal where you got, you know, five kids worth of pizzas and an hour in the arcade. And that was the highest bar of childhood birthday party that you could get.
Yeah. And that seems just about all right. Like, I mean, I think kids' birthday parties today have gotten kind of crazy, but my 15-year-old organized his own birthday party this year, and they went bowling and out for pizza. And we live in New York City, so we don't have to do that at the mall. But again, it's the same activities. It's like teenagers want to do the same things, you know, in a city or in the suburbs. And it actually doesn't matter if they were a teenager now or in the 80s. Like, people keep talking about how teenagers are so different today. They are digital natives. But I think that there are certain fundamentals that are really pretty much the same.
And how many of those fundamentals do we actually get to see on the big screen? Because there are quite a few movies that happened at the mall.
Yes. So Clueless has always been one of my favorite movies. And so I was really delighted when I realized that I could write about Clueless in this book. I mean,
it comes across, it really does. Yeah, right, I
know. Like, part of the fun of this book, it's like, yes, I'm an architecture and design critic. Like, yes, I'm a historian, but I think all of the projects that we pick are personal in some way, and that is kind of what makes them fun. So realizing that I had looped around to be able to write about Clueless professionally was just a fun realization. And probably, you know, I hope most of your listeners have seen Clueless. It's still my favorite, you know, adaptation of Emma. And there's a scene in it in which Cher, the Emma character, and her friend Christian, you know, come up into the top lit space of the mall on an escalator, and she flips her hair. And it's just clearly a moment where, like, these are kind of like the king and queen of the teenagers. And the fact that they have that scene framed in this mall space seems really significant to me, and points to the roots of the best mall architecture in Beaux-Arts architecture and classical architecture that would always kind of frame the most important people under the dome.
And well, that kind of comes to the title of your book, Meet Me by the Fountain. So many malls start at the fountain. I remember losing a friend in the mall one time and being like, oh, okay, we're going to walk around, or we're just going to go to the fountain and we're all going to end up there. And that is the focal point of so much stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great book written by Penny Spark called Nature Inside that goes into some of the history of conservatories, which then were adapted to be the centerpieces of semi-public spaces like hotels and department stores at the turn of the last century. And then that is what leads them fountains and you know, glass-topped atriums to being the centerpiece of malls. It's kind of adapted through the ages, particularly from department stores, and this idea that there would always be this place of rest with some plants and artificial nature at the center of the shopping enterprise. So essentially, you could catch your breath before you went to the next department in a department store or went to the next store in a mall.
Have you seen malls where they kind of combine the, when I think of some of these malls, it's like you have the fountain over on one corner, you have the food court in a different corner, and then you have some sort of like kid play place at, like, depending on if they're F's or O's or things like that. But does it seem to be a failure of a mall when they combine them all in one spot and that's the center of everything, or does it really lend itself to being spread out? How does that work?
Well, I think it really lends itself to being spread out. Like, and that's the DNA of the mall. When people talk about department stores being anchor stores, that's actually both a metaphor and the reality. Like, you couldn't get a mall started in the early days of mall development without having one or two department stores signed on as initial tenants. And that allowed developers to raise the rest of the money and then recruit other businesses to be at the mall. So the fundamentals of the mall are that you have these two anchor stores that will make people want to walk between them. People will go to the mall and they may enter at one end or enter in the middle, but they'll want to traverse between the anchor stores. And so, nowadays, our idea of what an anchor is and kind of what motivates people to go to the mall has changed a bit. So a child's play place is something that, people will both want to go to a department store and then walk all the way over to the play place, to pick up their kid from the birthday party. Movie theaters operate that way too. Just like, what are the drivers that will actually get people to move all the way through the mall rather than just popping in and out of these anchors at the edges?
When you go into a mall and you see too much of a particular thing, does it click in your head that you're like, oh, this one's on the way down? And what is that thing?
Well, honestly, it's usually like too many businesses that I've never heard of before, because that indicates that the mall is no longer attracting national or even subnational chain stores. And so they're starting to fill it in with local businesses. And that's not always a bad thing. There are some great examples of malls that have been entirely redeveloped, particularly those that have been redeveloped as ethnic marketplaces, where everything is a local business. And so I think if you go all in on that, that's one thing. But if you're a mall that's trying to be kind of a standard, like, serves everyone mall, and you can't get national chain stores, especially clothing stores, to be at your mall anymore, then that's usually an indicator that it's in trouble.
Here in Seattle, we have two malls that, first of all, they conform to your direction from the city naming convention, where you said there's the city and the name got appended to it of some north-south. And so we have a Northgate Mall and a South Center. And South Center is a mall going at full steam, owned by the, I believe it's one of the Simon companies, that you mentioned a few times in your book. And they have several different parts, spurs coming off the mall that have a grocery store, that have a big arcade, like an upstairs full bowling alley arcade thing, and then an entire wing of Nordstrom's and all the high-end retailers. Our Northgate mall just got light rail, and they immediately demolished half of it and put in the Seattle Kraken's training facility and are redeveloping the rest of the site for higher density TOD development. And so it's fascinating how as that mall is changing, it's still holding on to the name of the mall itself, the focal point of the community. And then there's just this lament of where did the mall go?
Yeah, those are great examples at like a number of levels. The first thing to note is actually that John Graham Jr., who was the designer of both of those malls, was really one of the earliest kind of mall specialists. Like if I'd written my book and living in the Pacific Northwest, I probably would have talked more about John Graham Jr. because he's kind of the local hero of malls on the level of somebody like Victor Gruen. So Northgate was actually one of the earliest shopping centers. It wasn't initially a mall because it wasn't enclosed, and it opened just a few years after Gruen's first shopping center, Northland, outside Detroit. But here you see like the confusion of the naming conventions. So probably at that time when Northgate was built, the northern suburbs of Seattle were growing. And so Northgate became like the anchor main street, essentially, of those suburbs. And then when South Center was built, it was the same for the southern suburbs. But you can also see in kind of what's happening to both of them now, like two of the divergent paths for malls. Like the other thing that a lot of people asked me when they heard I was writing this book, they were like, oh, so you're writing about dead malls. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, because like, yes, a lot of malls are dying. I don't deny that in any way, but a lot of malls are thriving. Like many, many people can point to malls that are thriving that people still want to go to. It's just, we're undergoing like a great retrenchment in the sector. So the fact that, you know, one mall is still thriving as a mall, maybe they've added on some things that are more appealing to people today than department stores, you know, food and marketplace uses and also entertainment uses are going to be really important going forward. But then on the other hand, Northgate, you know, still having some retail, but adding on the sports facilities and hopefully residential architecture to go along with the light rail is actually a great use because it's turning the mall into more of a mixed use enterprise, which is actually a much smarter way to use real estate in general.
We love to hear mixed use real estate.
Yes.
But that brings up one of the things of how separate malls were for so many years. And I really appreciated in your book, you didn't just emphasize the separation of uses inside the mall, the separation of uses of the mall from the city, but also how the mall ran segregation and kept races very separate too. And over and over, you mention there's a level of pandering to a particular class of white homemaking women at the very beginning of the mall, and how that thread runs through so much of mall design and our expectations of the mall even today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons it's so great that malls are now being, you know, remade as mixed use community centers is that, you know, one of the original purposes of the suburbs was to eliminate the kind of mixed use environments that people had downtown. It was seen as kind of a cleaner, more corporate, more manageable way to develop a city. And it's turned out to be, you know, kind of a bad way to develop a city in a lot of ways. But that was part of the point. Like in the suburbs, houses were here and businesses were there and they weren't supposed to meet. And then the mall was supposed to offer this cleaned up version of downtown where everybody was basically your neighbor, which meant everybody in, you know, these often redlined suburbs, you know, everyone was also a white middle-class woman with 2.5 children whose husband drove off to the work every day. So, I mean, I didn't find evidence of, you know, sort of specific racist policies in malls. But if you're building malls in these suburbs that were built via racist policies, the people that are adjacent to them and use them are going to be white. And then there was the additional layer of transit policies. Many mall owners didn't want to have bus access or like access for people without cars who might have been coming from cities. They would ask that there be no bus stop at the mall, or they'd put it across the highway from the mall. So like in a lot of ways, yeah, these were these isolated island-like environments that were meant just for the middle-class women who were stuck in the suburbs, middle-class white women stuck in the suburbs.
One thing going back to that original Victor Gruen pitch to who was the first, his big customer in Michigan?
In Michigan, it was the J.L. Hudson Company. The owners of the big department store downtown.
Yeah. And when he first made that pitch and he made it he actually labeled it a decentralization plan for the company because they had one big facility downtown. And he said, we're going in each direction. And I can't help but see how that plan echoes the decentralization of under the Defense Department Act and the Highway Act. Decentralization under urban renewal, decentralization under so many of these things. And I think that's one of the amazing threads that you're able to pull out in this book, how those trends in spreading out match corporate policies, city policies, federal policies all across the board.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's like absolutely true. I mean, Gruen was proposing Northland, Eastland, Southland, and Westland. Like that, basically, you used to have this 13-story department store in downtown Detroit, which a building that has now tragically been demolished. And instead, you were going to have these four malls. And Gruen was responding to urban patterns that were already underway. Like he was responding in some ways to the Highway Act, which allowed developers to create all of these new suburbs. And he was adding something that the suburbs lacked that was actually fairly important, you know, kind of a shopping center. But he definitely like wasn't pushing against the idea that he could make a, you know, cleaner, less diverse, you know, less complicated downtown than the one that already existed downtown. He was capitalizing on both like the fears and the hopes of the money people. But yeah, no, I felt like reading urban history, people often ignore shopping as a driver. And I think they ignore it for, you know, kind of lots of sexist reasons, like shopping is seen as frivolous. Shopping is seen as something that women are interested in. But in fact, most, you know, of the developers and powers that be behind these malls were men. And you know, shopping was a very powerful force in, you know, moving people around and enticing people to go places.
Now, this is where I'm going to get to the zombie question.
Okay.
do you go into malls these days and think, I could defend this place from a zombie attack?
Well, I don't, but I think that some people could. Yeah, definitely. No, but like one of the fun things with, you know, kind of going through the history of zombie movies and how from Dawn of the Dead on, which kind of sets the pattern, so many of the zombie movies are, you know, are set in shopping malls, is really the question of like, are we already zombies? Like, because we're at the mall, like, does the mall create the zombies, or like, do the zombies recognize themselves and the people at the mall? I mean, I feel like there's kind of an open question about like, which part of that apocalyptic fate is the bad part.
I was a little surprised that the zombies made an appearance in your book before the post-apocalyptic chapter. I was like, oh no, that part's going to actually cover the COVID-19 situation and we're going to go from there. So that was a little bit of a surprise, but I really appreciated deep diving into the shambling masses and how are we going to defend the place from across the parking lot, picking zombie off one at a time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dawn of the Dead is a late 70s movie, and you know, there's more recent literature, kind of like post-recession literature that also talks about malls and zombies. But George Romero, who directed Dawn of the Dead, was, you know, not ahead of his time, but I would say like right at his time. And then now we're getting this second wave of new interpretations. I mean, one of those things I say in the book is that the mall has been dying for a long time. There are malls dying stories written from the 80s to the present day. So the preoccupations of these, you know, writers and directors and artists thinking about it are in response to real news. It's just the news has been extended over many decades.
So Alexandra, when you go into a mall these days, what is your process to go through it? Are you actually studying it for design, or are you thinking, I'm going to grab my bubble tea and I'm going to go shopping?
You know, I don't actually shop that much. So I'm going to grab my bubble tea and then I'm going to circumnavigate the mall to see, like, kind of check in, like, is this following the patterns that I have seen before? Are there stores that I've never noticed before? You know, kind of like, I like to just check that, like, I've covered my bases. Am I spotting anything new in a mall? I'm actually going to Los Angeles at the end of this week, where I haven't been since pre-pandemic. And I have all these malls that I want to check in on as part of my itinerary, because I kind of feel like they're all of my babies now. And I just want to see, like, how are they doing? Like, what's happening? Because LA is really, you know, mall central. It's still a source of a lot of mall innovation. So I feel like if there are new things bubbling up, like, I might be able to spot them there.
What would you spot at a mall that would actually surprise you?
I mean, I have my eye out for new food businesses. Like, food is really huge in malls. So I would love to see some new food chain or one-off that I thought could really kind of become a phenomenon. Like, I'm very curious about that. I think the thing that would surprise me, honestly, is like a very healthy and beautiful department store. I mean, the part of the mall story that was saddest to me is that I think the death of the department store is happening. And like, I think that's fairly irreversible. And I've read a lot of department store history, like the early stories of all of these department store families, and the stores themselves are really gorgeous. So it makes me sad that we don't have that anymore, but I don't think that's a place where younger people are dying to shop. So actually, like, seeing a department store that still had the kind of glamour that people talk about in the past, that would really surprise me.
And that's it for this week's pod. We love to hear your thoughts. Send your comments, criticisms, and favorite mall food court recommendations to the podcast to podcast@theurbanist.org. Thanks to Alexandra Lang for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra's book is Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Pick up your copy and join us for the Urbanist Book Club discussion in early January. We'll have more details as we get them. We look forward to you joining us for that event and next week for another pod. I'm Ray Debicki. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk again soon.